As Luke McCann strode through the gate of the Tolliver and McClelland freight yard, a black man scrubbing mud from a wagon turned to watch him. McCann nodded a greeting, but the big fellow gave not even a grunt in return. At the doorway of the unpainted building of rough lumber, McCann took off his hat. Shifting it to his hands, he tried to swallow his tension. He couldn't. It was dark there. McCann stood blind a couple of moments as his eyes adjusted. He found himself facing three somber men on a bench against the opposite wall. Like wooden Indians in a cigar store, he thought.
Could you tell me where I'd find Ira Tolliver?
Wooden Indian number three tilted his head toward a door at the far corner of the room. It was ajar. McCann saw the corner of a big pigeonholed desk. He nodded his thanks and headed for the door. Inside the office sat a fat man with an unlit cigar stub jutting out over an impressive collection of chins.
What is it?
Are you Ira Tolliver?
I am.
I'd like to speak to you for a moment.
The man shrugged and McCann entered. The office looked as if it had never been cleaned. It was a refuge for stray odors.
You got business?
My name is Luke McCann. I'm looking for work.
Uh-huh. Somebody say I'm hiring?
No, sir. Just figured I'd ask.
What work you after?
I'd like to be a teamster. I got experience. Hauled freight in Missouri almost a year.
Oxen?
Mules.
We use oxen.
I can drive oxen, Mr. Tolliver. I've done it a time or two.
How long you been in Pierre, son?
About a week.
Where you from?
St. Louis.
You're young.
25. I'm told I look younger.
You've got folks?
No parents. They died just over a year ago. Wagon accident. I've got one sister living in Independence.
You know where my freight line runs, son?
Deadwood, I hear.
That's right. Black Hills. Gold country. A lot of young bucks looking for a way to get up there.
I'm not looking for a ticket to Deadwood. If I wanted to go there, I'd get on my horse and ride.
This line cuts through Sioux country. There's highwaymen, too.
I'll try to take care of myself.
Bill Hickok tried, too. He's moldering in his grave at Mount Moriah.
I'm just looking for a job.
Tolliver pondered.
We've got a shipment going out Monday. You come back in a couple of days, and we'll start breaking you in.
They talked pay, shook hands, and McCann left. Pierre stood at the bend of the Missouri on the southern Dakota Territory. Since the discovery of gold in the Black Hills, the freight business out of Pierre had flourished. Talk had it that Deadwood was a place of intense living and easily found death. The murder of Wild Bill Hickok there a few years back had only bolstered the gritty mystique of the town. McCann was a slender man and rather tall, his features smooth and appealing, if not outright handsome. He had dreamed of roaming like this from the first time he'd toddled across his nursery. McCann left the cafe and walked without aim along the street. In front of a store whose window sign read, Mining Tools, High Quality and Low Price, he paused to roll a cigarette. The door opened and a man emerged, arms filled with supplies. Blinded by his load, he walked directly into McCann. Tools and other goods fell all around him. The man cursed, directed at the situation rather than McCann.
If I'd seen you coming, I would have moved.
Not your fault.
Yeah, let me help you.
I'm Caleb Black. I'm obliged for your help.
You bound for Deadwood?
Like everybody else.
I'm heading that way myself. I'm a teamster for the Tolliver Company yonder.
Maybe I'll see you in the Black Hills then.
Maybe so.
McCann wrote a letter that night by candlelight.
Mrs. Martha Hyatt, Independence, Missouri. My dear Martha, as I write you now, I am a teamster. When you hear from me next, I likely will be a gold miner in the town of Deadwood. There is money to be made there at honest labor, and I'll be glad to make my part. Our father would have been proud of me, would he not? Making a living with the sweat of your brow always was his theme, with me at least. Though as a female, you probably were spared some of that. It is late, and I will not write you long, but you will hear again from me when I am settled at the Black Hills Mines. To answer the question of your last letter, no, I have not gambled away all my inheritance, though I have kept to my poker-playing ways. I see no harm in it, though I know in your eyes it is the fatal vice that will ruin my life, if not damn my soul. For you were well taught by mother about the wicked ways of men. But do not worry about me, and be sure you will hear from me soon. Your affectionate brother, Luke.
McCann labored through Saturday night, filling canvas sacks, heaving crates, stacking goods, covering the loaded wagons with tarpaulins. It was grueling work. McCann worked with Bob Webster, the black man he had seen washing wagons in the freight yard. Webster was talkative now, warmed to McCann through the Brotherhood of Labor. McCann asked questions and Webster answered them in detail. The freight runs were led by an employee named Benjamin Weaver. Webster pointed Weaver out to McCann.
Weaver's a good man to have leading. Listen to him and you'll learn a lot about this business.
Webster began McCann's education in the freight business. He gave a rapid-fire description of the train. 10 teams of 20 oxen, each team pulling 3 wagons hitched together, each wagon carefully weighted. Before dawn Monday, the train began its roll toward Missouri. Ben Weaver led. As the sky turned from black to lavender to pale gold, a sense of adventure filled McCann. The wagons reached Missouri, and Weaver halted the team near the ferry that would convey the entire train across. Indeed, it was almost noon before the chuck wagon at the end of the train was parked across the water, with a huge kettle of stew bubbling beside it. None of the teamsters had eaten that morning because of the early departure from pier, so they accepted the food with the eagerness of dying souls grasping a sacrament. Webster sat by McCann, who was propped against a wheel of his swing wagon. Webster pulled away his hat and wiped the sweat off with his sleeve.
Mighty hot.
It is. How long will we stay here?
Most all the day. The oxen can't take a lot of heat. We'll travel from the later part of the afternoon till we can't see no more.
A slow way to get to Deadwood.
You in a particular hurry?
I don't suppose, but I hear it's quite a place.
Oh, it is. You thinking of becoming a miner, maybe? There's nothing wrong with mining. A man sure can't get rich driving a team of oxen.
You're not coming back, are you, Webster?
Don't say that so loud. Old Weaver listens for such, and there's the devil to pay if he hears. I thought of leaving, sure, but it can be hard for a colored man to get work if the mining goes bust. I can't let go of what I got without a lot of thinking.
When the afternoon waned, the teamsters yoked up and rolled out. It was while the teamsters yoked their oxen that the first hint of trouble came. It was a freakish event, but it set off hard feelings that had stewed mostly unnoticed for months. Webster was yoking 2 oxen when Roy Sturley, a teamster from Arkansas, passed him. One of Webster's oxen moved suddenly and threw him off balance. Webster staggered back against Sturley, who dropped a yoke he had been carrying. It hit his foot.
Watch yourself, nigger.
Sturley threw a hard right against Webster's jaw. Webster squarely faced the man who had uttered and done what he would tolerate from no one.
Nobody called me that, Sturley.
The teamsters gathered. McCann edged in and touched Webster's shoulder. Webster pulled away as if it burned him. From the other side of the circle emerged Jimmy Wyatt. He was a short, slight fellow with flame-orange hair and a ruddy face dotted with pancake freckles.
It was the axe moving that done it.
No, he pushed me a purpose. You seen it, didn't you, Jimmy?
Sure did.
Just walk away from it.
Shut up, Luke. I fight my own fights.
Suddenly, Sturley lunged forward, swinging wildly. Several blows connected against Webster's neck, chest, and jaw. Webster recovered quickly. He threw himself on his opponent, slammed a hard fist against his eye, and pounded a left into his gut. The black man pounded 2 more bruising punches into Sturley's stomach. Then he heaved forward, head lowered, and butted a granite forehead against Sturley's skull. The crack was like mountain goats colliding. Sturley fell, but rose with a knife in his hand.
Yeah, cut him!
The men nearest Sturley parted suddenly. Weaver came through the gap, walked up to Sturley, and punched his jaw with one hand while deftly taking the knife with the other. Sturley fell back 2 steps, then looked into the train leader's cold eyes. His face flared livid, then drained to funeral parlor white.
But the darky pushed me.
Bob's my best teamster. I won't have you cutting him up. And as for you, Bob, I won't tolerate troublemaking or folks with chips on their shoulders. The rest of you clear out. We're losing time.
Sturley straightened and turned to Webster. The 2 stared like wary cats as Weaver walked away, confident from experience that his warning was enough to end the fight. For 2 days there was no further trouble. Webster calmed down but remained brooding and distant. Rain came and the going was slow. Streams swelled to twice normal size, and Weaver worried aloud about the Cheyenne River farther on. On the 4th day out from pier, the train encountered an immigrant wagon beside a stream. McCann recognized it as Caleb Black's.
Stuck trying to cross?
Could be, or maybe redskins or bandits. If you know this fella, come with me.
McCann pointed out 2 dead mules lying nearby in blackened blood, covered with flies.
Yeah, he was junked for sure.
Keep a sharp eye.
McCann could see now that the wagon had bullet holes in the sides and rips in the canvas. From inside it, a voice rang out.
Hold it there. Come around where I can see your faces.
Easy, friend. We're teamsters. Here to help you if you need it.
Come on, then.
He recognized McCann, even remembered his name.
Redskins?
No, white men. dressed like redskins to try to fool me, but I seen their faces. I'll know them when I see them again.
You won't see them. Most of the highwaymen keep hid out. If you turn up in Deadwood from time to time, Tim Branton and Evan Bridger mostly, nobody bothers them. The law has no proof on them, and most folks are scared of them.
I'll teach them scared.
You can ride into Deadwood with us. We'll hitch your wagon behind McCann's team.
I'm obliged.
Black rode in the seat beside McCann. The sun grew hot and the oxen slowed. At last, Weaver signaled a halt. When they stopped, Caleb Black crawled inside his wagon and went to sleep. By then, McCann had received a nutshell history of Black and his kin. Black's brother, Walter, was already mining in the Black Hills and had invited Caleb to join him. He answered McCann's questions. No, he'd not mined before. Yes, he'd read all about it. No, Walter was not rich. Not yet. But yes, he would be, and Caleb too. He was sure of it. The first sight of the Black Hills reconfirmed to McCann his plan to stay. From a distance, they truly were black because of the pine and spruce on their summits. McCann had picked up some of Deadwood's history along the way. The town had been founded in 1875 after the discovery of gold. The town was bordered by hills and thus had grown in a long strand. Along its rutted course sprouted businesses, some legitimate, others not. There were those who called Deadwood the Gomorrah of the West. The town prospered. The Black Hills swarmed with prospectors. Deadwood had a decidedly lawless streak, and every kind of human cast-off infested its alleyways and dark corners. The straight and narrow did not pass within 100 miles of the Black Hills. Deadwood was a rough and cruel town, a place men did not go if they valued their mortal lives and immortal souls. Naturally enough, it was crowded. The freight wagons rolled into Deadwood late in the afternoon. Weaver didn't hand out pay until the Teamsters were back on the Centennial Prairie. It was his way of making sure they returned. Caleb Black had remained in town. McCann thought about him just before he went to sleep. Probably he was looking for his brother right now, a stake waiting for him. A lucky man. In the morning, McCann and Webster took 2 horses and rode into town. They sought out Hardin Crowley, a fellow Teamster Webster said was honest, and gave him payment for the horses.
Take it back to Weaver when you leave. We'll not be thought horse thieves by any man.
Good luck to both of you. Next run, I'll be staying on myself. Wish I could now.
They left their horses at a livery and took to the street. As the sun rose, the drab town took on a surreal light that made it almost beautiful in a primitive way. McCann stopped. Approaching from the other end of the street were Sturley and Wyatt. The pair approached, keeping out of reach of Webster's long arms. They smelled like whiskey even at this early hour.
Can't you talk? It ain't polite to stand and stare at a man like a bug-eyed jackass.
Yeah, just move aside and don't cause trouble.
Trouble? Did I talk about trouble, Roy? Well, we're nice to everybody, even to niggas like you, boy. I'm talking to you, Webster.
Wyatt saw he had touched a nerve. He grinned.
I make you mad?
You did.
His hand flashed out with amazing celerity. Bone crunched horribly as Wyatt's nose went flat under Webster's fist. Sturley gaped, open-mouthed and silent, at his injured partner, who now sat on his rump in the street with blood gushing down his shirt.
You're dead, nigga.
His hand fell to the ivory-handled Colt he always wore. He drew and leveled it, clicked the hammer, and aimed the pistol between Webster's eyes. There was an empty click.
They don't work unloaded.
He kicked upward and caught Wyatt full force in the groin. Wyatt's body rose a foot off the street and fell backward. As for Sturley, he backed off, then ran. Webster knelt beside Wyatt and gently took the pistol from his hand.
I unloaded this while you slept the night after you decided mine and Sterling's business was yours.
Webster tossed the pistol into an alley. A drunk scurried to it, and then he and the pistol were gone. Webster and McCann walked away. Wyatt still writhed in the dirt.
It isn't over, Bob.
I know it. Maybe I ought to give me a pistol.
Both of us.
They heard laughter. McCann turned. A tall man with graying hair and a leathery face stood in the doorway of a tent saloon, a beer in his hand. He laughed at McCann and Webster, and when McCann looked at him, raised his beer in salute. The man turned back into the dark saloon interior.
Who was that?
Webster didn't know. The gun seller smiled throughout the entire transaction.
It's been a good day for Mr. Colt. I sold a pistol identical to these earlier today.
Yeah, let me guess. Shrimpy little fellow with a busted nose.
Why, yes. A friend?
an acquaintance.
Webster was silent a long time as they walked the street. McCann felt they were merely marking time until the next encounter. Night fell and brought out Deadwood's balance of human refuse. They reminded McCann of roaches scurrying from beneath his grandmother's old iron stove as she stoked it at the old Missouri homestead. He and Webster went into a saloon and crowded the bar. The place was packed, poker games underway all around. An enticement for McCann in the other time.
Take a look.
Wyatt and Sterley came through the front door. Both were very drunk. Wyatt's face was pasty, his nose puffy. The swelling made his eyes squint. Wyatt stared at them. His eyes, made ugly by his bruised face, narrowed and became uglier.
You'll go over to them.
No. Anyone starts trouble, let it be them.
The stare down went on another minute, neither side moving. The saloon door opened and a drunk came in and stumbled against Sterley. That broke the back and forth eyeballing and Sterley and Wyatt left. Webster and McCann found a table and sat down.
There's no reason for you to get any deeper into this. It's my fight.
Not just yours anymore. They've drawn a bead on me, too, just for being your friend.
Maybe we ought to work a claim together when this is done.
I thought of that myself. We'll talk it over when we get all this behind us.
Let's get it done.
Together, they left the saloon. As they passed the door of a brothel, Wyatt and Sterley stepped from an alley and faced them.
We're going to settle it right now, nigger.
Move aside.
Sterley, as usual, looked scared.
Let's let him be, Jimmy. I don't feel like killing nobody.
Wyatt saw his chance at battle slipping away. He flung a bitter frown at his partner, paused a moment, then grabbed at his pistol. He was clumsy, inexperienced as a gunman. That gave McCann and Webster time to leap to either side. Wyatt's first shot plowed the dirt. McCann drew and aimed at Wyatt, but the freckled redhead dodged back into the alley. Webster's pistol homed in on Sterley, who ran off wildly into the darkness. Everything yielded to silence and racing pulses. Then someone yelled,
"Look out!"
A shot roared and Webster stabbed as if bolt struck. His pistol fell to his feet. McCann saw Wyatt. He had come around the building and shot Webster in the side. McCann yelled and swung his pistol around as Wyatt sent two more slugs into Webster's body. McCann fired but missed. Wyatt turned to him as Webster collapsed. Suddenly something loomed between McCann and his foe. McCann saw a dirty white shirt stretched over broad shoulders, a head of collar-length gray-black hair. The man raised a Remington and fired. Wyatt's body kicked back and he was dead. The tall intruder holstered the Remington and turned and smiled at McCann. It was the man McCann had seen laughing in the saloon doorway earlier in the day. McCann went to Webster. Another man came to his side. It was Caleb Black. He touched Webster's bloodied chest, felt for a heartbeat, and shook his head.
He's gone.
McCann sat in the darkest corner of the darkest saloon he could find and brooded over a beer. Though McCann and Webster had not known each other long enough to be truly close friends, McCann had sincerely liked the man. Caleb Black entered the saloon and found McCann.
I'm sorry about your friend. At least the Wyatt boy got what was due him. But let me tell you something. I recognized the man who shot Wyatt.
Who?
I don't know his name, just his face. He was one of the bandits who robbed me along the Deadwood Trail. I'll find his name, just you wait.
His name is Evan Bridger. Luke, I got to thinking about you and Webster staying on, and I just couldn't leave. I sent your money for the horses back by Sterling Slater. I heard about Webster. What a shame.
Tell me about this Evan Bridger.
Nothing to tell but his name.
Yeah, I owe him my life, I suppose.
I owe him, too. The man tried to murder me on the trail.
McCann saw a change of topic was called for.
Did you find your brother?
I did. He has a place out toward Lead. Just a shack, but on a good claim. I'm welcome there, and that's what counts.
Yeah, I wish I was in your shoes.
At the moment, I'm mostly interested in Evan Bridger.
And what are you hitting at?
It's personal, not your worry. Suffice it to say, you don't harm a black unless you're ready for the same in return. Eye for an eye. That's in the Bible.
Yeah, so is Balaam's jabbering ass.
McCann stood and walked out of the saloon.
I don't think he means it personal. He's worked up about Webster.
I don't really care. I know what I need to do, and I'll do it. Evan Bridges should have never took the first shot at me.
Hardin Crowley and McCann stood by as a hired preacher assured them that the colored brethren do have souls, that Webster was as much a man as any of us, and McCann, never having thought otherwise, merely shrugged and gave the man $2. Crowley left, and McCann meandered alone about the grave, trying to figure out just what was nagging at him. He wandered over to a spruce grove and went to sleep. When he awakened an hour later, he thought he had it figured out. It was that Sterling had gotten away clean after starting the whole thing, and so far he had taken not so much as a fist in the jaw for starting a run-in that had cost a good man his life. Well, God help him, McCann would make Sterling pay. McCann hefted his Colt and studied it. He looked round for a target and settled on a pine knot many yards distant. He carefully aimed and fired. The pistol bucked. The knot didn't even spit dust. He fired again until the chambers were empty. Not a hit. McCann holstered the pistol and headed back into Deadwood. He rode down the center of the street and pretended to himself to search for Sterling. He thought he saw him, and suddenly his last meal was at his throat, threatening an exit. Better practice some more. Not ready yet, he thought. The next day, he went back to Webster's grave and practiced. He came back the next 2 days. Each was the same. Shoot out more ammunition, gather a little more skill, a little more confidence, and ride into Deadwood looking for Sterling, but not too hard. Finally, he allowed himself to drop the pretense and admit he didn't really want to find Sterling at all. It wasn't Sterling's escape from punishment that ate at him. It was that he himself had been so scared when Wyatt faced him that he probably would have taken a bullet had not Evan Bridger stepped in. It was a waste. He couldn't bring back Webster. He spat a curse and fired off a quick shot at a blackbird on a pine stump. The bird flew into feathers and red spray.
Now you're getting the hang of it, son.
McCann wheeled. It was Evan Bridger.
I've been watching you shoot. You got skill, but you try too hard. Over aim. What you gotta do is let that pistol become part of your hand. Point it like a finger. You hit your target 9 times out of 10.
McCann was wordless. He felt strangely odd.
Let me show you.
He drew out his Remington, and 5 quick shots erupted. 200 yards away, a pear-sized rock became dust. McCann found his voice.
Luke McCann's my name. I want to tell you how grateful I am for what you did back in town. Though I'm not sure why you did it.
No, I'm not either. Seemed the thing to do at the time.
And you probably saved my skin. I'm not much good with this thing. I wasn't any good at all when my friend needed me to be.
You much shooting in your boyhood, son?
Nothing much, with a pistol.
Well, listen up, you'll be a good pistol man, too. Being a good pistol man can be a good thing, or bad. Depends on how a man uses it.
How do you use it, Mr. Bridger?
Any way I please. I see you know who I am.
I asked.
Well, I expect I'll see you around some more.
Bridger mounted a big black gelding and rode away. McCann suddenly felt a crazy urge to do 2 contradictory things, to warn Bridger of how Caleb Black had hinted at retribution for the trail attack, and to raise his Colt and put a slug through Bridger's brain. The first urge was the offspring of gratitude. The second came from some deeper source that one day McCann would identify as intuitive foreknowledge, but which now seemed mere insanity. So he did not shout or shoot. He just watched Bridger ride away. McCann wondered why he remained in Deadwood at all. So far, he had made no attempt to become a miner. He was a good poker player, and Deadwood a good poker town, so he easily made enough money to sustain himself. Secretly, McCann worried. He felt like a powder keg that might blow or just might fizzle out. He had gone through something like this right after his parents had been killed, but it hadn't lasted. Webster's murder had brought it all back, though. He thought of writing his sister for advice, but not now. Later, when he was through gambling. Bound for trouble, bound for crime. Such had been his own mother's prediction for him. He remembered it often now and didn't deny it like he once had. He'd think about it again after the next poker game. A rain came and went. McCann walked the muddy street. A man across the street caught his eye. He was dark, so much so that McCann first took him for a black man. On closer inspection, the man proved to be an imprecise mongrelization of Spanish and Anglo, with maybe some redskin thrown in. Noticeable as the man was, it was the one with him who drew McCann's interest, Caleb Black. Black spoke to the dark man, then glanced around the way men do at the doors of back street brothels. Black and the man walked into an alley. His name was Morgan Ham. McCann learned it when they brought him in, draped over the back of his horse.
Somebody tortured him bad. Whoever did it didn't want him dead too quick.
Now why would they want him dead at all?
Him's a hired gunman. Kills for pay. Probably whoever did this was supposed to be his victim, but turned the tables. He probably got tortured so you'd tell him who hired him.
McCann thought about that a moment, then said,
"Oh, no."
McCann ran for the livery. Where was Caleb's brother's claim? Out toward lead, Caleb had said. McCann had to get there now. He galloped through the middle of the street and out of town. McCann rode past claims where miners labored. They watched him with vague frowns, seeing urgency in his manner.
Where's Walter Black's place?
Yonder, maybe half a mile.
McCann spurred his tiring mount. He rounded the bend a quarter mile ahead, then reined to a halt. A rider came toward him, lazily plodding along. It was Evan Bridger.
Howdy. Fine day, Mr. McCann.
McCann dug rowels into horse flesh and plunged on, fearing it was too late. Walter Black's claim was humble, a simple shed with a canvas roof. McCann dismounted in the yard of pounded dirt. Slowly, he approached the open door.
Hello, Caleb.
He pushed the door further open. A man sat at the table, leaning back against the wall.
Hello, Caleb?
The man said nothing. McCann understood why. This was not Caleb Black. He had found Walter Black. He had been eating bread with butter and drinking coffee when Bridger came in. In Walter Black's forehead was a neat, round bullet hole. McCann did not want to see more. He called Caleb's name and headed toward the woods and heard a faint but identifiable sound, a man crying. McCann followed the sound. He found Caleb Black hugging the base of a tree, crying with his eyes squeezed shut.
Are you wounded?
Black shook his head.
Walter's dead, Caleb.
I know.
Evan Bridger did it. He probably thought Walter was you.
I just hid. Hid like a coward.
Come on. We've got a grave to dig. So what will you do, Caleb?
Mind this claim, I reckon. And I'd like you to help me.
Yeah, all right. I'll try it for a few days. But I don't know a thing about mining.
I'll show you what I know.
That proved to be relatively little, but the work satisfied both of them. 3 months passed. McCann was convinced by then that Caleb Black had gotten over Walter's death. They never discussed it, and he no longer bore the haggard, haunted look that had marked him those first days. Then, one night, McCann awoke and found Caleb's bunk empty. He went to the door and saw him outside, walking around fast, pumping his arms up and down like a man about to explode. McCann knew then that he had not gotten over the murder at all. Maybe never could. For almost 6 months, they mined their gold as usual, every day like the rest. Black seemed happy, and there were no more restless nights. Then, one night in early spring, he left. McCann found a note on the door. Bridger in Wyoming. Gone to find him. Maybe back soon, or it might be a while. Whichever, you keep on, all the gold is yours. She'll see you again. Caleb. McCann kept on alone for a week. But without Caleb Black, it was dull work. One night, he slipped on his hat, pocketed his money, and rode into Deadwood. Mining gradually gave way to poker. Jack Parker was a big man with smallpox scars, a little talent for poker, and a propensity for big talk. McCann took a bit of his money over cards nightly for 2 weeks, but Parker never seemed to mind.
I like you, McCann. The kind of a man I like to work with.
Yeah, what line are you in?
High profits, son. We'll talk some more about it when the time is right.
McCann dismissed the vague talk and concentrated on his gambling, but then his luck went bad. Parker came to him and threw a fleshy arm across his shoulder.
Take a break from the game tomorrow night. Head out to the little house beside Tobert's gunright shop. I want to talk business.
McCann nodded without much thought. The next night he went to the designated place. When McCann came, Parker scowled at him.
You're late.
Now explain all this to me, would you?
They're coming.
Who?
The two riders came past the window and cut around the house. Parker rushed to a back door and opened it. McCann recognized two men who sometimes joined the poker games. They dismounted and walked around to a pack horse they led.
Did you get it?
Take a look.
He and the other man lifted a pack off the back of the third horse.
Get it inside.
Inside, they laid the pack on the floor. Parker closed the shutters and threw back the cloth pack cover. Underneath was a small but heavy strongbox. Parker rubbed his hands together, then fiddled with the lock.
Hey, what's going on here?
What's it look like?
Like robbery.
Who is this? Why is he here?
He's a latecomer. He's fine. Just not filled in yet.
Yeah, I don't want any part of this.
There, see? Why are you always dragging in extra baggage, Jack?
Parker didn't answer, for he was working on the lock with a saw.
I'm leaving.
He turned towards the door. One of the men made as if to draw his pistol, but McCann drew first and thrust his weapon against the man's chin. Just then there was noise outside. Then they heard voices.
Law!
That's the law out there? And me in here with...
Parker leaped aside, stuffing money in his pocket. He ran out of the back door and the others followed.
Open this door!
McCann almost obeyed, then thought again and ran after the others out the back door. He rode as hard as he could until he was out of Deadwood and knew as he left he could not go back. A week later, McCann sat by a campfire on the windswept prairie and wrote the following.
My dear Martha, I'm thinking of you and home tonight, because now I've got no home at all. My old partner, Caleb Black, about who I wrote you before, is gone. Headed out to find a man who killed his brother, and probably will kill him. And that is a shame, because Caleb is a good man, but for his temper and his vengeful ways. I have not done well, I'm sorry to tell you. In your confidence, I will be honest. Without meaning to, I've fallen in with common outlaws, and I guess I'm not much better than one myself. If you scorn me for this, I do not blame you, and expect no better. Our mother might have been right about me after all, though you always took my side with her, which I will always be grateful for. Anyway, I am out of Deadwood now, and near the Powder River in the Montana Territory. I'm sorry also to tell you, I've been playing poker a lot more again, and may have to keep it up to make some money. Though, like you always said, it takes a man's worth from him to live on gambled money. Forgive my gloomy writing, but it makes me feel better to tell of it, even though I know you would want to hear better from me the next time I write you. And maybe even by the time you receive this, my situation will be better, for I am nowhere near a post and cannot send this until I don't know when. Your foolish but devoted brother, Luke M.
McCann was playing poker in a saloon at Rosebud when he encountered a man he had not expected to see. Parker rose first.
Roy Sterling, well, I ain't seen you since we gigged frogs together back in Arkansas.
Roy smiled at Parker, then saw McCann. The smile vanished, but McCann did nothing. What went through his mind was this.
If I'm so low as to run with a $50 robber, I might as well go dishonorable all the way and just let Sterling off the hook.
Luke, I want you to meet the finest partner a man ever had. I grew up with this cuss. Roy Sterling, this here is Luke McCann.
Yeah, we've already had the pleasure. Sterling and me have known each other since we were teamsters together. Right, Roy?
Well, who'd have thought it? Roy, sit down. Let us deal you in.
I'm broke.
Your credit's good with us, Roy. Right, Luke?
Well, I recall that I owe Roy a little something myself.
They played 2 hours and McCann won handily. He rarely cheated at cards, but tonight he did, just to drive Sterling deep into his debt. When the game was done, Sterling was humiliated, McCann satisfied. The group retired to the prairie for the night. Parker was saddened and mystified by Sterling's nocturnal departure.
I can't figure it out. Why would he do it?
I guess we'll never know.
Well, he'll miss out on a good deal.
How so?
Rustling, my friend. Rustling.
McCann immediately saw a clear image of himself swinging a couple of feet above the ground, neck stretched out nearly a foot long. It was enough to empty his stomach, but he only smiled. From that moment on, he looked for a chance to leave. None arose for a long time, not until days later when they reached the breaks. McCann spent one night there, and the next day, when darkness fell again, he took his horse and rode 15 miles through the night. Satisfied he had not been followed, he relaxed, let a deep breath of relief flow out like a prayer, and put his days of criminal association forever behind him. Then he cut southward and rode toward the little settlement of Glendive, having no plan, no goal, and very little money. In Glendive, McCann found a job as a clerk in a general store. He passed a spring and summer in relative comfort, but in the fall and winter, business grew lean. McCann turned to the cattle industry. His job was to keep the cattle at his home ranch within the spread's accepted range, and he did the task well, despite no cooperation from weather or cattle. When spring came, he moved on, looking for a larger spread. He bought a weary old horse and a good saddle and rode to the Timber Creek Cattle Enterprise about 50 miles west of Glendive. There he sought out the ranch boss, Abe Hunt, and asked for work. The company rep's name was Henry Sandy. He looked like a Bostonian and talked like an Iowan. He chose McCann and five others. Hunt sealed the choices with a nod. Hunt motioned McCann aside.
That horse of yours ain't worth pole action. Pack it in the corral and pick out a good one.
McCann went to the bunkhouse. It smelled almost fishy from sweat, and McCann was further disheartened to see a grizzly of a man pick a louse from his beard and throw it to the dirt floor. McCann jumped and almost yelled when the man suddenly produced a pistol from beneath his blanket and shot the evicted parasite.
A big un!
McCann drew his Colt and pumped two more slugs into the floor at the man's feet.
Sure was. You just winged it.
After, he walked out the door. At least three men had witnessed the incident. McCann figured he had just saved himself a lot of harassment. The story would spread ranch-wide, and the Timber Creek crew would know he was no greenhorn ripe for torment. McCann was given the job of preparing the chuck wagon for Roundup. Helping him was Stuart Biggs, the lice shooter from the bunkhouse. They worked under the guidance of John Weatherby, the Timber Creek cook. McCann was popular among the crew at large. A particular friend was Dan Tackett, nearly 20 years McCann's senior, and an old man among cowboys. McCann learned that Tackett had once been married and had lost a son to the Cheyenne, a boy who, Hunt told McCann, looked a lot like him, something McCann took as a partial explanation for Tackett's attachment. 2 days into May, the Timber Creek punchers rode into Milestown to begin the roundup. McCann rode beside Tackett as they slowly approached Milestown. The town looked sleepy and drab, but that was a mirage conjured from the mist of the nearby Yellowstone. Milestown was no Deadwood, but it was a lively enough place, particularly when cowboys were in town. McCann dismounted at the circus of cowboys. It seemed all of them were talking, laughing, and cussing at the same time. McCann wandered through the crowd. At length he saw a rope corral in which a husky black man carefully approached a horse with a wild eye. The man slowly twirled a rawhide rope as he eased up to the defiantly snorting horse. He was like a cat, moving silently, loop always twirling, until at last he cast it true over the horse's neck. McCann found him later, sipping coffee beside one of the chuck wagons.
You did a fine job on that bronc.
Thanks.
He looked up, and McCann drew in his breath. Bob Webster.
You all right, friend?
I don't know what to say. You're the image of a friend of mine who I lost down in the Black Hills.
You knew Bob?
Bob Webster, right?
He was my brother. I'm Bill Webster from the Lazy Arrow.
Well, I'm proud to meet you, Bill. I heard Bob speaking. My name's Luke McCann.
McCann? You were with Bob when he died?
Oh, yes. But how...
He told me.
The black man pointed at an approaching figure. It was Hardin Crowley.
Luke! Never figured to see you turn cowboy.
What about you, Hardin? I thought you'd still be in Deadwood, getting rich.
Left 2 years ago. I see you done met Bill.
Yeah, thought I was seeing Bob's ghost for a second.
I saw your old partner a while back, down in Bozeman.
Caleb?
Yeah, but you'd hardly know him. All beard and grit and muscle. He's had a hard road to follow.
What's he doing now?
What do you think? He's trailing Evan Bridger, and it's making him and Bridger both a little famous. There's a magazine back east that wrote about them. Called Bridger the bad man with the ghost at his heels, the haunt that won't let him rest. Would you ever have thought such as that out of Caleb, huh?
After the first week on Roundup, McCann quit counting the days. All was repetition. Only the terrain varied. Most days, McCann worked closely with Dan Tackett, particularly when they entered the land around the Yellowstone. McCann galloped to the top of a ridge and looked down as Tackett rounded a bluff and entered a small, lush valley where several cattle grazed. Tackett waved to indicate he saw him, and McCann sent his mount, half sliding, half walking down the slope to him.
Look at this!
They dismounted and walked to the little valley's gap-like mouth. The valley was really a box canyon, and across the entrance was a thin strand of barbed wire. McCann understood what it meant.
Look here. There's been a camp here awful recent.
Yep. And I bet if you check them cattle, every one will have a brand that ain't on the record books yet. This is a running iron operation. Russell Mavericks, brand the yearling, rebrand the others, hold them until you can register the brand. and have you own herd free and clear. Nobody the wiser.
Yeah, I guess we ought to tell Abe.
Hunt inspected the new brands on them.
Yep. Running iron, no question. I've seen no brand like this one before.
Think we'll find whoever did this?
Nah, I doubt it. They probably cleared out for the breaks.
But the next day, Tackett flushed from a coulee a couple of Mavericks, a 5-foot rattler, and a very scared man. Tackett brought the man into camp. Hunt watched the man with a grim, ominous expression.
Who are you?
Terrence Brown. I'm from the XIT, at least till a month ago, when I had to take off.
Yeah, why'd you do that?
My old mammy took sick, and I had to get her to a doctor in Milestown, but she died.
Well, why are you out here alone?
I was on my way to Rosebud with a man named Ernest Smith. My horse hit a hole and snapped its leg, and I had to shoot it. And then he just popped me with his gun butt and left me. I don't know why.
Yeah, you say you worked at the XIT?
That's right.
Till a month ago?
Yeah.
Hunt called to one of the men back at the chuck wagon.
Hey, Dillard! Come up here.
A gangly fellow rubber-legged it over to him.
Mr. Brown, Dillard here worked at the XIT not 3 months back. He knows every man on the place. Hey, Dillard, you know this man?
Never seen him before.
I've seen him.
It was Lester Tracy, a young man just shy of 20.
I can't give you all the details, but I was with a bunch of cattlemen who cleaned out a nest of cattle thieves here a few months back. And this here's one that slid it out.
If I'm being accused of a crime, I want a fair trial. A courtroom with a real judge.
Yeah, we've got no need for such.
Someone found a rope and knotted it into a hangman's noose. Brown watched in horror. They dragged Brown, kicking and yelling, to the cottonwood, where they stood him atop a keg from the chuck wagon and tightened the noose around his neck. McCann's pulse raced as he watched. He was glad he had left the company of Jack Parker.
Yeah, I'm sorry there's not enough drop for a proper slack. We'll just have to let you choke it out. You want a prayer from anyone?
Brown only glared at him.
Well, whatever you prefer. Goodbye, thief.
He kicked away the stool. Brown choked, his face red, eyes bulging, horrible sounds coming from inside him. McCann was about to turn away when Hunt threw his pistol and shot the rope in two. Brown dropped to the ground on his rump.
Yeah, I spared you because I'm a man who can hardly stand to kill a rattler, not because you deserve to live. Now I want something from you in return. You go to every rustler you know and you tell them this territory is full of cattlemen who are about to go to war. There'll be no mercy shown like you've gotten here. Tell him you were lucky. Go on, get out of here.
Hunt drew his knife and cut off most of the rope, but he left the noose on his neck, and he used the cut-off rope to tie Brown's hands behind his back.
You can't send me out like this. There's no telling what'll happen to me.
All right, then. We can go ahead and hang you.
Brown cursed, but started walking. Tackett drew his pistol and put a slug into the dirt at his heel, and Brown ran. Among cowboys, Jonas Carrington was exceptional. He had a family, though only a daughter, for his wife was dead, and he had his own house, away from the ranch. His daughter, 2 decades old, was a dark-haired beauty whose picture Carrington kept in a pillbox in his pocket. Carrington was shy and quiet by nature, but throughout the roundup he had been even more reticent than usual. Near the end of the roundup, Carrington approached Abe Hunt.
I've got to go, Abe.
We will go in about a week.
Something's wrong back there. I got a feeling. I got to go back now.
All right. Head on back and do what you need to do. I'll see you back at Timber Creek.
Thank you, Abe.
He walked away, rubbing his left arm as if hurt. The next morning, Hunt shook McCann awake just before dawn.
I want you to ride back home with Jonas. I don't think everything's all right with him.
Yeah, whatever you want, Abe. Why is he going back?
Hunt filled him in. Carrington said little to McCann. When he did speak, he wasn't unfriendly, but preoccupied. They rode until their mounts were lathered and puffing, then paused to give them rest. McCann ate some jerky from his saddlebag. Carrington refused it. They changed mounts and rode on. McCann noticed Carrington favored his left arm, holding it awkwardly as he rode. McCann asked him about it.
That's nothing. I strained it a couple of days ago, throwing a calf.
On they plodded. At sunset, the clouds opened and red light streamed like blood through the gash. Carrington rode to the top of a slope and halted. He rubbed his left arm again. McCann stopped beside him. Below lay a small cabin beside a creek that gushed rainwater. A light winked on in the cabin window and spilled out around the edges of the shutters.
Everything looks fine, Jonas.
Carrington, still silent, dismounted about 100 feet from the house.
Maggie! Maggie!
No answer came. Carrington drew his pistol and went to the door. With a kick, he shattered the latch and the door burst open. In one corner stood Maggie Carrington, pale and scared. About 10 feet from her was the rustler Terrence Brown, holding a rifle. He fired. A slug sang past Carrington and McCann. Carrington moved to the center of the doorway. His pistol thundered and flashed orange fire. Brown screamed and grasped his chest. Carrington fired twice more. Brown was dead. 3 wounds in his chest. Carrington walked to Brown's body, looked at it, then groped at his heart and slid slowly to the floor. He took one shuddering breath and died. It was his heart that killed him. Brown's shot hadn't even come close. McCann and a neighboring rancher named Orrin Marby buried Carrington. In the meantime, Marby's wife took in Maggie, who had become hysterical for only a few moments after her father's death. Then she had pulled herself upright and forced tears away from her eyes. McCann slept a few hours before starting back for the roundup. There, news of Carrington's passing was taken badly, particularly by Hunt, who blamed himself for not snuffing out Brown when he had the chance. When the roundup was done, McCann rode to the Marby spread to check on Maggie and found she had gone back home. The girl had vowed to live at her own place, regardless of the bad memories and the loneliness. That made McCann respect her. She was a young lady with grit. He rode to her house and found her at the well. She was a pretty lady, there was no denying. Slender, of medium height, her face oval with freckles, her shape utterly feminine. He greeted her, and she smiled in return.
Wanted to see if you're making it all right.
You're kind, and I am all right.
I was surprised to hear you came back here so fast.
I've never run from memories, even bad ones. Mr. McCann, I owe you thanks for the help you were to me. I should have thanked you earlier, but the time wasn't right for saying anything. You understand?
Of course.
McCann looked at the cabin. He noticed a torn muslin window flapping in the wind.
While I'm here, I might as well help you out some more, if you don't mind.
She didn't, so he repaired the window, restoring the waxed muslin. They talked quietly as he worked. When he was done, he said goodbye and rode away. When he was out of view, he reached into his pocket and pulled out Jonas Carrington's pillbox. He flipped it open and looked at the picture. He shouldn't have done it, picking a dead man's pocket, but he wasn't sorry. He pocketed the box and spurred his horse across the prairie. In the days that followed, McCann returned more frequently to Maggie's home. He would work, they would talk. She began fixing some of his meals. McCann thought of her constantly. He spent a lot of time looking at the pillbox portrait. But their involvement remained quiet, mostly private. And it remained, to McCann's disturbance, rather cool. McCann always was aware of something in Maggie's eyes, in the tightness of her shoulders that kept her a little distant from him. He worried about it, laid awake about it, but said nothing. The unseen barrier was there when he left for fall roundup, and there when he returned. Hunt assigned McCann to line camp duty, and he knew he probably would see Maggie not at all through the winter. The thought was a dull cramp inside him that did not go away, even when Maggie gave him a sack of books as a defense against the inevitable boredom of the lonely winter camp. She was a cowboy's daughter. She understood. The snow hit quickly and hard. McCann reached the camp as the first flakes fell. Wind whistled around the cabin. Every crack in the chinking spewed cold air. McCann huddled beneath a buffalo robe and drank coffee. He heard a noise outside. One of the horses? When he heard it again, he stood. He checked his pistol and slipped it into the waist of his trousers. He went to the window and partially opened a shutter. Biting wind struck him. The darkness was heavy as a sodden blanket. He could see only 6 feet, and there was nothing out there but darkness and snow. Then he heard the neighing of a horse.
Hello, camp.
The wind distorted and weakened the voice.
I hear you. Ride in.
He wrapped the buffalo hide tightly around his shoulders and put on his hat. He threw open the heavy slab door and went out. The rider approached on horse that appeared ready to drop. Huddled in the saddle, the man looked like he was carved from an ice block. He slumped from the saddle as McCann reached him. McCann struggled inside with him and put him on his grass-tipped bed. He threw a blanket over the man, then went outside and took the horse into shelter. In contrast to the bitterness outside, the cabin seemed warm and life-giving. McCann knelt beside the pale man. He touched him. He felt like a corpse fresh from the mortician's ice ring. McCann took the right hand and slowly began rubbing the blue fingers. He warmed the left hand, too, then the toes. The toes worried him. They were badly frostbitten. But to his surprise, the toes warmed beneath his fingers. He felt the throb of a pulse and glanced up at the face. Color was returning as the ice melted from whiskers and hair. McCann worked his way up the arms. The man's breathing deepened. He was asleep. McCann looked again at the face and pulled back as if a gun had fired near his ear. Caleb Black. He was bearded, much more weathered than before. The nearly 5 years that had passed since last he had seen him had left deep tracks, but this was indeed Caleb Black. An hour later, Black stirred.
Well, how's it feel to be froze, Caleb?
I thought for a minute I was back in Deadwood.
Now, you might have suspected this was the Heavenly Gates, considering how froze up you got yourself.
I got lost out there. I was on my way to Milestown.
Now, you're a long way from it. Why did you come this way?
Give me some coffee, I'll tell you.
McCann gave him a cupful. Black drank slowly, taking careful swallows that made him wince.
And I hear you still trail Evan Bridger. Is that why you're in these parts?
It is. I came out here to find you. I heard you worked the Timber Creek spread. I had to look you up.
I can't believe you still chase Bridger. You can't bring back Walter.
It isn't just Walter anymore. I got married, Luke. Annie was her name. And Bridger killed her. Killed them for she had a baby in her.
I don't know what to say, Caleb.
When I met Annie, Bridger didn't seem to matter anymore. I fell hard, Luke. You ever had a thing like that happen to you?
McCann smiled rather sadly and nodded.
I married her. We settled down to start a family. I did this and that to keep us alive, hunting, trapping, trading, whatever. We weren't rich by a long shot, but we were happy. I all but forgot about Bridger. But he didn't forget me. He showed up one night when I was gone. He shot Annie. Shot her dead, right there in our own home. Left a note pinned to her body, telling me the things he'd done before.
Aw, damn, Caleb. I had no idea he'd put you through that.
It's what he put her through that eats at me. I swear, Luke, I'll be on his trail until one of us is dead.
I understand. How long will you wait?
I'll leave as soon as the snow lets me.
Black waited out the day and one more night, and then was ready to go.
I'll see you again, Luke.
McCann nodded. He watched Black ride away until he was a spot on a field of white.
Caleb, you get him here!
Black nodded and waved, then disappeared into the vast whiteness. The stranger's name was Jephthah Avery, or Jeff, and until recently he had been a woodhawk along the Missouri, supplying wood to fuel the steamboats. Now he was a range detective. Hunt, as usual, took the lead, and with few preliminaries explained why the group had come.
Yeah, this spring a group of us will ride north to the breaks of Missouri and clean out that corps of rustlers. Jeff here is familiar with the area and knows the whereabouts of the main troublemakers. We hope to bring them back alive, if possible, but dead if need be. We want you to be a part of that group, Luke. It's specially selected, hand-picked secret. Could be dangerous, but I'm asking you just the same. Will you ride with us?
He tried not to show it, but McCann was flattered that he had been asked. He accepted solemnly, and the others looked pleased, except for Avery, who seemed indifferent. Hunt turned to more mundane talk. He quizzed McCann about his work. McCann gave a report, then asked about news from Timber Creek. He was thinking of Maggie, but did not mention her.
We got us a new town getting started right here.
McCann expressed amazement. Tackett nodded and went on.
A man named Rodney Upchurch has come up from Milestown, and once the winter breaks, he's putting up a big store. Upchurch's Emporium, he'll call it, just like the one in Milestown. One thing I'll say, he's a real character. Sort of a city type, all bouncy and starry-eyed.
Where will it be?
Within view of Maggie's house.
How is Maggie?
Fine, doing fine.
Hey, wait a minute. Is something wrong with Maggie?
Hunt and Tackett exchanged glances.
No, she's fine, like I said, and we really do need to go.
They all went out the door and mounted. McCann, knowing he had not been told all, went to Hunt and asked again about Maggie. Hunt paused and looked him in the eye.
Rodney Upchurch is courting her. Has been since he came. And that's about all there is to it.
McCann looked at him silently, then nodded. The three rode off, Hunt and Tackett together, Avery slightly behind. For the rest of the winter, McCann did not see another human being. He was glad of it. Upchurch had wasted no time. As McCann rode home, the last real snow, a memory of 2 weeks back, the framework of a large building stood starkly against the sky. McCann admired one thing about Upchurch, even though he had not met him. A venture like this took grit. The store was miles from the nearest town, lonely and isolated in the middle of cattle range. Yet the notion was sensible. Many who lived here made it to Milestown maybe once or twice a year. A closer outpost would be a luxury. Upchurch might just succeed. Too bad. For the next 3 weeks, McCann stayed to himself. He volunteered for jobs that took him away from the ranch, away from other people, and when he was not gone, he remained aloof. At times, he reminded himself of Ben Weaver back on the Deadwood freight train. He saw Maggie only at deliberately great distances. The thought of her stabbed him every morning and stole his rest at night. He began gambling again, slipping off to poker games in back rooms or organizing his own in the bunkhouse. But his work did not suffer. Pain only concentrated his efforts at whatever he did, and he worked with great intensity. Meanwhile, the courtship of Maggie and Upchurch progressed. Maggie Carrington awoke to the sound of someone approaching outside. She dressed quickly, combed her hair, and went to the door. It was Luke McCann. She threw a shawl about her shoulders and pulled it tight, then stepped outside and waited for him.
Maggie.
Luke.
She pulled the shawl tighter, seeming to shrink within it. Her face was very white.
There are things I wanted to be different. Maybe I was the only one who did. But it makes no difference. I'll be leaving here soon.
Where will you go?
Does it matter?
No, I suppose it doesn't.
McCann studied her white face, trying to remember how she had looked to him before, but he couldn't.
Goodbye.
I'm going to marry him, Luke.
McCann rode away, but he would not look back. He rode until she was far behind, out of view. Then he stopped. He looked eastward, considering very seriously just riding until he was lost somewhere in Dakota. Riding off and never coming back. But no, he had promised to do a job for Abe Hunt. Do it he would. When it was done, he would be free. He thought about that for a time, waiting for it to make him feel better, until finally he was weary of waiting. McCann rode alone, wondering what was coming and why he had agreed to take part. Really, he knew why, because Abe Hunt had asked him, and because he really had nothing else better to do with his life at the moment. When he was within 300 feet of the camp, a husky black man appeared in the doorway. It was Bill Webster. McCann felt a burst of relief. If Bill, clear-headed as he was, had agreed to become involved in this, maybe everything was square. Then he realized that Bill might be just as lacking in information as he was.
Have a hard ride?
No problems.
McCann peered into the cabin and saw the shadowed form of Jeff Avery. Lizard in a hole, McCann thought. There were others with him, but McCann could not recognize them. The cabin smelled earthen and was cool. A pungent scent of strong tobacco hung inside.
Luke, this is Jed Stroud, boss of the Lazy Arrow, and Solomon Smith and J.W. Anderson, same spread. This is Luke McCann, a good friend.
Hands went out, were shaken. There was tension here, palpable nervousness that exhibited itself in fingers a bit too stiff, grips too tight, nods of greeting too quick. Only Avery seemed calm and detached, his eyes in their usual droop, his lip in its usual snarl, defying anyone to move or impress him. Abe Hunt arrived the next day, and with him was Tackett.
Thank you for coming. This is serious business, maybe a dangerous one. But we're no lynch mob, not unless we're forced to be. We've been doing a lot these past months to trace down the points from where the worst of the rustlers operate. We plan to move into those points quickly and quietly, taking prisoners. If they resist, we shoot them down. If they don't, we take them alive. That's the rule we'll abide by.
Avery began talking, laying out details, background, plans. He was a vulgar man, obscene in speech and manner, and talked in ways that hinted at something other than the peaceful venture Hunt envisioned. That drew sharp glances from Hunt. Avery softened his words in response until finally Hunt seemed satisfied again. But Bill Webster leaned over and whispered to McCann.
There's a man with a personal grudge.
At noon, they rode out, taking it slow, moving in a line toward the Missouri. But the further they rode, the more unsettled McCann felt. Don't turn coward, he told himself. But it wasn't cowardice, more like intuition, forewarning. There had been a cabin here once, but it was now, for the most part, a relic. Only canvas covered the top, but the cabin obviously was occupied, just as Avery had said.
Good spot for a wrestler. Hidden away, nobody even knows it's been lived in.
Which are these?
Leroy Bain and his boys. Small-time stuff before, but now they're tied in with bigger operators.
Across the clearing from the cabin was a small stable and corral. At Avery's direction, the men divided into two groups and crept down separately, drawing closer to the cabin. McCann, Hunt, Bill, and Tackett comprised one group, Avery and the rest the other. They moved quickly but quietly, then crouched and watched the cabin from both sides. A man came out. He wore filthy long underwear with a missing back flap. His hair was matted from sleep. He was rolling a cigarette in one hand and using the other to open the fly of his underwear and relieve himself just outside the door. Avery shouted,
Leroy!
Cigarette makings and spray went everywhere, but the man in the long underwear didn't remain flustered for long. He vanished into the dark cabin, and a moment later, a rifle muzzle slid out the front window.
Who are you?
Get out of the cabin. There's 30 of us out here.
I recognize your voice, Jephthah Avery.
Why does he know him?
Bring out your boys and drop your guns, or we'll roast you alive in there.
Bain fired, shooting the cottonwoods and sending the raiders ducking. Suddenly, another shot jolted out, this one fired by Jeff Avery. Hunt swore.
Why'd he do that?
Suddenly, the canvas roof was in motion. It bulged upward, then down again. McCann saw a man dart into the rocks and brush behind the cabin. Leroy Bain fired again, this time with better aim. Dirt kicked up near Strout. Strout lost his balance and fell back on his rump. Bain fired again, and Strout grabbed his shoulder. Hunt raised his rifle and fired at Bain. McCann and the others did the same. With the first spray of lead, a tone had been set. Now there was only one thing to do. Fight the best fight they could. They fired again and again toward the cabin.
You've hit my boy! We're giving up. Coming out. You've shot my boy. He's bleeding bad.
Bane's rifle flew out of the window a moment later. Bain came to the door, hands upraised. Jephthah Avery raised his rifle and fired. Leroy Bain fell dead with a bullet through his heart. Avery stood and rushed across the clearing. As the others watched stunned, Avery stepped over Bain's body and entered the cabin. There was a muffled yell, then another shot. Avery emerged from the cabin with a grin on his face and his rifle raised triumphantly in the air.
Do you know what you've done? You know that you violated everything we set out to do? Turn this thing into a mission of murder.
It wasn't just me shooting at Leroy. Besides, he shot at us first.
He was surrendering, Jeff. Nobody but you shot at him then. He had no gun. And worse, what you did to the boy, shooting a dying young fellow, you had no call to kill.
It was mercy. He was suffering, and I spared him.
Seems to me this Leroy Bain knew you right well. You wouldn't have killed him to shut him up, would you?
I don't like your tone, fat man. If you're accusing me of...
murder, you're worse than the rustlers you're hired to take care of.
Avery lunged at Tackett, who seemed to expand to bear size, arms stretching out toward his attacker. But Hunt put himself between the men, pushing Avery back to his seat. McCann jumped in to restrain Tackett. Bill Webster came through the door.